welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. And tonight, another hopefully very great show dealing with metaphysics, spirituality, science issues. And in particular tonight, the most possibly important issue for most people is how does their mind work? And is there any way to improve upon it and maybe even reach a state of perfection? We'll deal with those questions and much more. Tonight, I thought we would also deal with some of the questions of both physics and metaphysics in terms of looking at how this great facility of a human being is both different from, we'll say, animals, and how it is able to do its job and sometimes not. So we're trying to cover a whole wide area of stuff. For those of you who know anything about mental yogas, I'm going to bring in some concepts from a yoga that I and some other people helped to develop called synthetic yoga. But I will not be specifically instructing people how to use it or any of those factors. It's still even in its infancy and experimental stages. And one thing is known for sure, unless you are at a very specific point, which I'll talk about, it's not really helpful. It may not even be good for you. So you got to look at it from all the different angles. But that's only a small portion of tonight's show. Really, it's about the general subject. And let me kind of give you an idea of what I'm talking about. Since tonight's show, the correct title, Improving and Perfecting the Human Mental Body / Mind. What's the difference between a body and a mind? I mean, I think that's a relevant question if the show's going to be about that, right? And to define those, the body is an instrument that similar to what we consider in mechanical forms, we'll say storage medium and a sensing device, both together. And it allows something that we'll call right now the mind to use it in a fashion the way we use technology, I mean, in general. So consider it this way. It's sort of like an extension of ourselves. Of course, we consider our bodies ourselves, most humans do. And so maybe that will be confusing rather than helpful. But again, trying to find analogies to these ideas is not so easy, because to us, we seldom, ponder on whether it's our mind or our body that's doing whatever it's doing. Most of the Western theories in science use the idea of body, brain, and mind synonymously, and unfortunately confuse the subject rather than to lead it into any direction of enlightenment. And so it's a real, we'll call it quagmire, trying to define anything in the terms that people might be familiar with. The best way to understand this is in the way that I was starting, which is that we have senses. And the senses come from areas that we may not fully identify or understand called chakras. The chakras that have consciousness connected to them, okay, consciousness connected to them, are connected simultaneously to the brain in each body that there are senses in and to the mind. The chakras that do not have consciousness in them connect only to some part of the brain, but usually not in human beings, the part called the cerebral cortex. So the brain is divided up in a human being, different from some animals and, of course, other life forms. The brain in human being is divided between what is sometimes called the animal brain. That is not confusing at all, and that's actually what Western science calls it. And the part of the brain that humans have developed to a very high level, and that is the upper part of the brain, the higher part of the brain, higher brain functions. And the higher brain functions are the part that are consciously connected to the mind. All right, but the mind in the two lower bodies is not located in the same dimensional space, not the same dimensional space as the body itself. So that's kind of a confusion, right? I mean, you would expect, as it is in lower forms of animals, that there's some kind of instrument we call a mind that is in the same dimension of time and space that the body is in. That's not true in human beings. So where in the heck is the mind in a human being? And we'll get to that in a minute. But, I mean, this is, again, it's like one of these things with the Chinese box. You go in further, oh, there's another box. Okay. So it does get a little tricky. But I want to stay on the easier side, which is, okay, let's stay with the senses and the brains right now. So let's look at the physical body. The physical body has two parts to it, okay? It has the matter part. Everybody knows what matter is, right? You can knock on it, hit it, or whatever. Then there's the electromagnetic part, which is still a type of physical energy, but its frequency and sometimes its phases are not the same as the material side or the we'll call it the dense form side. And that electromagnetic side, or sometimes if you're into metaphysics, called the etheric body, has a duplication of all of the parts that we are familiar with in the physical body in some way. The chakras of a human being, of course, are found in the etheric or electromagnetic part of the generally physical mind. And the connecting areas that we sometimes refer to as sensory organs or sensory centers are in the material or physical or dense physical, to be more accurate, body of the human. So for our purposes, we could call the whole shebang of the physical body the combination of both major, there's seven chakras, each with a connection or consciousness in one way or another to the mind and to the physical brain in the physical body. And then we have the sensory organs, which are not necessarily located even in the same general two-dimensional locale that they're found in the etheric body. And those organs do some similar but not the same kind of activity in terms of mobilizing energy, changing or transforming energy from one state to another, using, and that's like eating food and changing it into heat and energy of movement, which is used in muscles and that sort of thing. And finally, there is this, we'll say, connection between the conscious centers and our senses and the non-conscious chakras or centers, which are hundreds and hundreds, which carry out a lot of functions in the body and somewhat are connected to the brain, by the way, but in the lower parts of the brain where things are done subconscious to the conscious part of us, which we call ourself. Interesting. Very interesting. All right. So when we talk about consciousness of a human being, it's always related to how much input is going through the conscious chakras that are located in the etheric body. And if that number falls below about 50% or so, we lose the state of what we call consciousness to the point where we no longer are self-controlled of what is taking place. Part of us may still be somewhat conscious of what's happening. I call that the personality, which is just a name for like the subconscious part of us in metaphysics, different from psychology. But nonetheless, if we look at the entire way this operates, there is a explanation for why it's done this way. The main point being that information is almost always stored in the body that the information came through or from using the senses and chakras. So information does not travel into a different body from where it is garnered. So if you live in the physical world, where I assume most people, if not all, who are listening to me at the present time, are located, the information you are receiving, including my voice, is being converted, it's being stored first in your higher cerebral cortex. It's also affecting lower parts of your brain and being stored in areas like the limbic system, like the thalamus, and parts where your emotional imprints are also being stored, but those come from another direction. I'll talk about that in a minute. And then finally, you also have a sense, we'll call it, of the densest elements in the physical world, which we call pressure and touch and so on, et cetera. And that's actually stored in the lowest part, not the midbrain, where I talked about the limbic, but in the very lowest part of the brain, the brain stem, where, like, the most basic forms of life may have some sense, including plants, by the way. Okay, so we kind of like go up the evolutionary ladder, you can say, in the way that our brain is formed. And the fascinating part about all of this is that there's a real good reason that you want to store information about the world around where the body is in the brain that's located in that locale. And that's because things go in and out of the brain from the mind to the body that it is connected to. If you try to connect, let's say you miswire this whole system, and I'm going to explain some unfortunate cases of this that we're familiar with. But let's say you miswire this, and the astral body and its brain get miswired and terribly connected into, in a direct fashion, to the physical brain. Well, when that occurs, a number of different types of conditions, from, you know, Asperger's and all kinds of diseases that we think of as diseases anyway, start to occur, and including autism. And so once that starts to happen, now it can happen because somebody is exposed to shock and awe during a war situation and develop literally shell shock, and maybe in the next lifetime even they could develop autism. But it also has to occur from any kind of severe emotional shock that has a physical characteristic accompanying it at the same time. And once that happens, it can develop into different diseases in that lifetime, and more often than that, diseases that can be developed in the next lifetime because of miswiring problems due to spiritual genes having karmic problems with them. And in working out the karmic problem, this misconnection gets put into the whole equation at the same time. Obviously, that's something we want to talk about tonight because that's we want to improve upon that, right? It's something we might be able to get rid of if we understand the problem. Now, you're going to say, well, you're probably shaking your head and say, yeah, well, if that's the problem, modern science is so far away from that idea. How are they ever going to fix it? Well, give it 20 or 30 years and people will start buying into some of the things I'm going to be talking about tonight. But for right now, I agree that if there's neurologists, and I believe there are maybe a few, that listen to the show on occasion, They may be shaking their heads. No, you know, I'd say, oh, this has got to be crazy. But if you listen further, by the end of these couple of hours plus that we're going to talk tonight, almost maybe go to almost 3 hours tonight, you'll get an idea that maybe this thing is for real. Maybe this guy isn't as crazy as it sounds. And the stuff I'm talking about comes from a body of knowledge called Aesop's Wisdom. Not that it is one thing. It's an ongoing and changing thing. Some people prefer the word ageless, you know, in one way, and others say ancient in another. So, you know, either you got ageless and is growing, or ancient and it probably never changed. I think that it's the obviously ageless, because to me it constantly is changing and growing, because human beings are growing their minds. And we're going to talk about that more, too. All right, so here we have an interesting paradigm, as I make like a big, it's a big word for examples, of how it can be put together. So if you can tie together examples to make kind of a theory, that's a paradigm. And so we can kind of do that here. We can start seeing that there's madness to this purpose, or purpose to this madness, I should say. There's purpose to the madness. Maybe there's madness to the purpose, too. In that it is an unusual system, because in some ways it's almost bulletproof. It really protects itself, because you isolate bodies and the mind is still in another location, which we're going to get to where it is. And this has some saving grace. It means a person can still think and have a damaged brain. So that's a good thing. But you occasionally get things going haywire, and they're misput together. And when that takes place, we have problems with things that we can't quite understand why they're happening. We know certain things to do to try to help people who have the problem, but we don't exactly have the, say, real solutions, because we don't have an understanding of what the problem actually is. All right, when I say we, I'm talking about humanity in general. I think I know, but those who are listening can check it out for their own life. All right, let's talk about the mind now. I'm going to go to the other two bodies, but I want to get the mind involved here. The mind is actually in the two places. It's in the lower mental body and in a little sliver, a fraction of an energy field called a petal, like a flower petal, in the lowest part of the higher mental body. And these two parts make up the human mind in most people. Now, you could say, well, how come a human's mind, as you're describing, it sounds like it's in a very small place. It is, actually. It's in a very, very tiny place. For those who understand subplanes and planes and all that stuff, I'll just say it. It's on the first three subplanes of the fourth subplane. We are in the same place. The personality exists in a subconscious state. And then it's also, the mind is connected from that in the human being to the lowest three subplanes of the causal body or higher mental body, again, where both the personality and the self have some connection. And the self in the lower mental body is, and this is going to sound strange, below and outside of the area where the mind is in the lower mental body and where the personality is. So the self is lower in the mental body in terms of, we'll call it, mental dimensional space than the personality. And that means the self is not conscious very well of its own personality because of its very location. And it also isn't very conscious. Now, this is something to think about here. It isn't very conscious of the forms of thought that it is using and where they come from, which is the first, second, and third sub-planes, where the personality is, nor is it very conscious, and possibly even less so, of the concepts that it tends to use, if they are not spiritual ones, in the higher mental body. So, because it's so distant from them, it's disconnected from even the personality to some extent, and it has to develop a connection to these places. When we are born, okay, during the first couple of years, the self is almost completely disconnected from those areas. And so we have very little memory on any conscious level of what happens, occasional pieces, but not continuous memory. And we further develop a kind of, live for the moment, experiential life to ourselves, because the self is the part of us that plans and sees future events, but it requires the use of the higher mind, the causal body, and the self has almost no connection to the causal body during the first 2 years of the average person's life. And you might say, well, what good is that? You know, why don't they do something about it? Why isn't that done in the womb? And it is done in some animals that way. As a matter of fact, the higher animals tend to do that more. But in humans, because of anatomical difficulties in women to be able to stand upright and at the same time carry a baby to the point where the head would have to grow large enough, so a lot of the physical connections could be made to the mental part of us and to our mental mind, including our mental body. And I haven't gotten to that yet. But the problem is that we have to grow outside of the womb this part, and it takes, for a lot of people, a couple of years. Now, if you develop the self in a number of lifetimes, so it is connected above the lowest three places that the self under average circumstances connects, you can be born with extremely brilliant abilities, even at 1 year old, and just knock the socks off of people. And you will have memory of that time, and better coordination, better abilities at doing a lot of things, because you're not just a self, you're not just a subconscious person. You were conscious. That person was conscious at that time. Now, it's rare that this occurs, but we see examples of it here and there in the human population. These are advanced people, almost always are spiritually disciplined people in prior lifetimes, and sometimes they're very advanced. More often than not, they are at the end of the second, usually in the third or the fourth initiation in terms of spiritual development, for those of you who understand what that means. So it's a kind of a fascinating thing to even get this far and to understand that humans are so vastly different from really the superhumans that are ahead of them, that they eventually make themselves into, or those species of life below them, including their fond pets, who have a little tiny bit of self being developed. But again, they are not as advanced as a human being, and they don't have this special condition of personality other than what they tend to develop and by being around humans. Animals away from humans live off of the group soul's instincts and have a very common or, we'll say, connected interest in terms of personal factors. So they live more connected to the species. Even if there are animals that tend to isolate themselves, they still act or react very much the way other animals of their kind react and act. Not so with the pets we have, right? We see some individuality coming into play because we start becoming a helpful, we'll say, growth to them in terms of their self, which is a good idea. All right, so humans can develop a self at a very, very early age, and as a matter of fact, soon after birth, and there's even been some examples of maybe even before birth, but the point is that that level of self is the exception in comparison to the vast majority of human beings, which don't have such a characteristic. Therefore, before age two, we see very little self-development in the human being. They act more like the pets that adults and older children have than as individual selves. Now, I don't want to insult anybody. Like, well, our kids aren't pets. So, yeah, but if you look at a 1.5-year-old, say, and their ability to even remember what happened last week, to plan what's going to take place tomorrow, to have any sense of what is called the full spectrum of time that the self has, you don't see it. They have a subconscious way of reacting at the moment, which is pretty much called, in metaphysics terms, the personality. So they have a personal interest in things, but not a self interest. They don't look to develop themselves beyond the moment. Well, that kind of fits a lot of people's understanding if you look at it from that standpoint. They may not disagree with them. They are not animals per se, because every day they grow more and more at a faster rate than any animal I know of, including the orangutan, which is not a stupid or even lower conscious animal. It is by far one of the most conscious, and yet a human child could quickly show the development of self much faster. Now, could a animal with human contact, especially like an orangutan, develop fairly sophisticated and, we'll say, completed self structure? Yes. Up to about 5 or so, we could expect that they could develop that level in comparison to an average human. Not compared to someone who's spiritually well-developed or something else. But to the average human, they could get that to that level. And that's the problem, though. They will stop at a certain point. Now, why is that? Well, humans continue to develop the concept realm beyond the part of the lowest 3 sub-sub levels of the higher mental body. This is the most critical part of what a human is, and is so different from an animal. Animals just can't kick it in gear and get up beyond that level. So they don't experience what we call spiritual concepts. The 3 lowest sub-sub planes, the 3 lowest parts of this, it's called a K3 pedal, provides a lot of the concepts that a self begins using quite early. Those 3 lowest are not spiritual. They don't include God's thought. They only include concepts that are non-spiritual. Okay? Are you with me? And they include all the isms, like progressivism, spiritual, non-focused kinds of things, like communism and even capitalism. And to a less extent, democracy, but all of the elements that we sometimes say are big concepts are really the smallest. They just are the biggest that don't have a spiritual connection. When we get above, on the very same pedal, but there's above it in the spiritual part of the mind, humans develop from about age 4 on, this part of the mind. Now, like a 3-year-old, that's an average 3-year-old, is not going to have very good spiritual concepts. And they might tell lies, they might do things that we would consider to be not very virtuous. In other words, they'll be selfish. By 4, they start doing the opposite. They start being concerned about the spiritual side of life. And by 5 or 6, that is where the major part of their development is. And we usually don't want to put them into circumstances where they have to demonstrate say, social skills until they're at least about 5 or 6 years old. And interestingly, not by design, but by more by the facts of existence, that's when we tend to send most children to public school or to a school in general. Yes, you can put them in preschool, but usually it's emotive factors that are dealt with there and not so much the aspects of what we're calling the mind. All right, so at this point, now it starts to make some sense. You know, it's starting to fill in the gaps of why we have a mind and where it is and what it's doing. So the human mind is very different from the animal mind because an orangutan can end up in a situation, that's a fairly bright animal, where it has developed some of the concepts that humans have, but it can only flirt from, again, being around humans a lot with elements of, we'll say, spiritual factors. And the thing that is missing from this great animal, and then from our dogs, our cats, etc., is they don't have an understanding of something beyond the form nature of existence. They don't have an understanding of God. Spiritual is the thought of God, the part of the mind of God and the thought of God. And so they don't have a direct input into God. But we do. Humans do. The chakras, called the heart and crown, or head chakra, and the consciousness of those two chakras, when connected to the mind, do not connect with the lower mind. They connect with the higher mind, and specifically they connect with the part of the higher mind that is above the three lowest sub-planes where all of the normal discussion kind of areas where we read about and talk about between ourselves that humans exist in when they're not being spiritual. But that's where those chakras get information that is fed into bodies and eventually leads to the mind's ability to garner information. It's direct information that comes through these chakras that makes us different from animals. And it's the reason humans are out looking for and praying to and doing so many other things because of God. And you don't see that in animals. Just plain don't see it. Even if you try to train an animal about this by asking it questions, do you ever think about what happens when you die? You can do this. You can actually do this. The animal is curious, but is not informed. It doesn't have any self-information about God to relate to what it is even told using sign language, as has been done with certain apes. And so it cannot have a full understanding. It just has a trace coming from its lower concepts, trying to apply them in some way to an idea that's completely foreign to it, because it has no input of information. This is the difference between what we would call a human and an animal. There are some humans that fall into the same category that animals are in, where there's something faulty, we'll call it, in one or more of their bodies, heart and crown chakras. When it's in particular in the astral body, and somewhat in the mental and physical, you end up with people who are called sociopaths, and sometimes if they're very, very off the beaten path and wrong, they could be psychopathic, meaning that they actually seek the death or destruction of human life and sometimes other life as well. So this is the kind of a problem that humans have as, we'll call it, a nemesis to deal with, that there are times when the human doesn't develop properly, possibly and almost always in some ways related karmically to past lives and other factors. And the human is born without this connection from the lower self into a more spiritual thought process, because they can't identify with anything dealing with spirit. Now, a lot of people are going to say, well, does that mean all atheists are like, you know, some kind of sociopathic thing? No. Atheism is caused by people having a dominance of lower mental, higher mental, lower sub-subplane thought. In other words, the fifth, sixth, and seventh sub-subplanes of the third petal, which is called the K3 petal, are so dominant in those people. They're sometimes quite smart, but they also usually are quite egotistical and even arrogant. And this leads to the dominance of those kinds of concepts overpower the sense they're getting from whatever amount they have from their heart and crown chakras in the three bodies. And the result could be, instead of being sociopathic, although they could become sociopathic, they oftentimes, in a state of egotism, become what I call the basis of progressivism, and particularly in those that are anti-religious viewpoint and even anti-spiritual issues. And some are divided up this way. Some reject religion but still are spiritual. Others reject spiritual, in which case they usually aren't religious unless they're using it as a means to an end. But it is a critical element here to realize that they may not be sociopathic as much as they are, we'll say, a bit on the amoral side, or maybe non-virtuous in certain ways in comparison to this. So the point is, and it, some people call it secular progressivism. That's the word that has recently been coined in the last 20 or 30 years. Yeah, but then you have to decide, is it a person who's against religion but is spiritual, or is it a person who is anti-God, period? That's a tough one. And some people, you know, I don't think that that word does justice to the two different concepts. All right, so in the way I'm trying to describe this, I'm hoping that you're starting to get I'm trying to build a very complicated system, but in as simplistic a way as possible without doing it injustice, to develop it in a way so that we can really come to, you know, a really good understanding of what is going on in human being in comparison to anyone else, and how we can therefore improve the human and eventually perfect it, truly. So this is what we're aiming for, and I hope I'm slowly getting there. Okay, so now I'm going to switch gears. I'm going back to the astral body, and I'm going to talk about the astral chakras, and which are centers that bring in information. And again, the way a sense or center connected to a sense, which is really the formation of the sense, works is that the energy in the center or sense, both, has to be more developed than the energy that it is gathering. Because one form of energy attracts another that is more developed than the lower form of energy is in terms of its quote-unquote thinking. Energy, when it thinks in a very low way, is called gravitating energy. And when it thinks in a high or higher way, and again, energy, thinking about how energy thinks is a little strange. That's a whole other program talking about how the energy kingdom, the sub-kingdom actually, but how it actually works. It's very, very interesting, but can't get into it tonight. But if we want to understand how a sense works, we have to realize that the energy in the sense has been refined, has no longer wants to just hang around with other energy similar to itself, which is called gravitating energy, but it wants to be able to work with other energy to develop its own thought, and eventually an energy being. Wow. But it goes in the opposite direction from the way we develop ourselves. It's a strange system. So the energy in our centers is actually called, mostly composed of devonic energies, which are these kind of energies that are more towards the spiritual side of existence, and they attract a lot of energy that is gravitational type of energy to tell us what is going on outside of our spiritual mind and even the subconscious part of ourselves, which is the personality. So we rely upon these energies to do this for us, and they're part of our body. In the astral world, this is kind of fascinating. In the astral world, this is taking place at a much faster speed and a more complex dimensional way. Now, I'm going to come back to this. We'll take a break for right now, but I'll come back to this, and let you cool off for a couple of minutes here. And then when I come back, I'll explain more in depth how this works, because it's a little more complicated, because we have another dimensional aspect to it, than the very straightforward way it takes place in the physical body. So we will be back in, give or take, about 2.5 minutes from right now.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. McFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight we are talking about improving and perfecting the human mental body/mind. This is a little complex. I apologize to those of you who, on a Friday night would rather be just daydreaming or something. You can't do that with tonight's show, that's for sure. There's a lot to be said, and I will have enough time because we actually can go longer tonight. If you stay tuned, I'll be on probably for about 2 hours or 40-some-odd minutes. That is an amazing thing. Again, thanks to the radio station for that. They're letting me go longer, and I love it. And therefore, I can have shows like this because, frankly, by the end of tonight, you're going to agree that there's no way we could have done this in two hours or less, and for sure could have done it back in the days when I used to be on for an hour. I don't know how I ever did any of those shows, because you just can't explain these complex subjects in ways that people can understand them. You go too fast. fast, and everybody goes, huh? What do you say? Yeah, and I know you can re-listen to the show in a few days, but the point is that even when you have that as an option, it's good to get it at a slower pace to begin with, because your foundation is there, and you can say, oh, I missed a few things, but at least I got a general idea of how it works. Okay, so we're talking about how the astral body works in terms of developing sense. And it's an interesting thing because in the physical world, we're very familiar with the three, quote-unquote, dimensions of time and space that we live in. The fourth dimension is usually referred to as time, but it's a very incomplete dimensional issue. And in terms of space, we usually refer to it as height, width, and depth, right? Three dimensions. But in the astral world, there is a fourth actual dimension besides time that is the direction and intensity together of energy. Direction and intensity of energy. So what does that mean? It's dimensional. Well, that means that if you change the literal dimensionality in three dimensions that the intensity and direction of energy is moving in, you end up with another whole dimension. And I'll put it in as an example so you can understand it, because what I just said probably went, what do you say? Imagine you and I are standing in the same place in the astral world. All right, we're in the same place. The difference is that my energy that I'm in control of through my mind, which is in the it's part of the astral world, but it also is located and controlled by my personality itself in the middle world. That mind is using thought that is formulated in astral dimensionality so that I can understand the astral world. And in this case, it uses creative imagination. All right, in my creative imagination, there is a thing that affects how I want the energy to move. If I want it to move from me to others for the benefit of the others in some way, we call that love. Hey, cool. And how and where and when I choose to do that determines where I am in the astral world. Okay. So if you decide that you want your energy moving towards yourself because you're selfish, okay, I should reverse this. Let's do it this way. If I decide I want my energy moving towards myself because I'm selfish and I really want to just have a good time and lots of fun and, hey, excitement too, the energy by moving towards myself puts me in a certain place in the astral world. It's called the lower subdimensions. But let's say you, who's literally in the same three-dimensional place, but you want to give to others in a very appropriate way, you want to be a helper to others so they can become giving, you're in a much higher dimension, subdimension, in the same three dimensions that we both exist in. You're in a different place entirely. And that just changes everything, doesn't it? So that's what's the difference between the astral world and the physical world, is there's an added dimension. And the added dimension is so vastly increasing the space that we're in that the astral world is no less than seven times larger. Actually, kind of innate. But it's at least seven times larger than the physical world that we're familiar with. Now, if we look at Earth with its atmosphere inclusive, it goes out maybe 30 miles, you know. And then the Earth itself is another, as you are familiar with, about 8,000 miles in diameter. So you got a relatively small area for what we're thinking about, 8,000 miles, not that big. Like, the astral dimension is much, much larger. Now, it gets a little bit complicated because you would say, well, if it's seven times larger, then isn't it 7 times greater than the 8,030 miles or so? And no, it's actually bigger than that, and I'll explain why. There are not just 7 times the size, but there's there's another multiplying factor, which is time, because it's another dimensional part of the space. And so you have to add to that about, this gets funny, up to 24 times the dimensional differences. And the 7 times is at, in comparison from one place to another, and there's a part of the astral world which is very different, and that's called the A-sphere, which negates some of what I'm saying and actually inverts some of the process. But regardless of that, you end up reaching to the far side of the moon, and how far is that, you might say? Well, give or take, that's about 250,000 miles. So that's the size of the astral world? Yeah, it is. In a very odd way, it is. But we don't notice that even when we live in the astral world, because our perspective becomes one aspect of what we both desire and how we interpret those desires in comparison to what we sense. So we make our own existence, so to speak. But if someone were able to look into the astral world from a perspective outside of it, and some beings can do this, they would see a very different picture of what the astral world looks like, the one that I'm describing to you right now, than someone living in the astral world. Because someone living in the astral world thinks they're actually on Earth. And they're usually not even close to that. They're sometimes tens of thousands, 100,000 miles away from Earth, but in a physical sense. But they think it resembles Earth to them, where they're at, and so that's how they perceive things. Now, when they look up in the sky to them, they still see the moon, but the moon looks much larger or much smaller, depending upon where they are in location to the moon, than it would be normally. And a lot of other things become disjointed due to the change of what they want to perceive as the world that they exist in. Very strange place to be, isn't it? Okay, so the astral world, because of the three-dimensional, adding another dimension to it, gets very confusing. People literally are like upside down and sideways, and they don't even know it, in terms of the relationship they are to each other and to the physical world. But regardless of that, the senses, the astral senses, have to be able to work in this really crazy environment. Crazy by our standards in the physical world. When someone has an out-of-body experience and they go to the astral world, they have to use consciously their astral senses to maneuver around this world. Well, normally, those senses are only used subconsciously by the personality and only in terms of what feelings they have coming from their astral body. They don't perceive the astral world as such because they're not living it. Now, when they're in the astral world, their consciousness is shifted to the astral senses completely, and they have to perceive the astral world. And during an adjustment period, usually it's in hours of time, but sometimes it could be much longer, people have to start learning how to sense correctly the environment that now has this added dimension to it. And their astral senses work very differently. They can project them outside of their body great distances. They can telescopically look at things. They can microscopically look at things. They can also hear things very far away, and they can sense the feelings of other people in things also very far away, provided that they have an understanding of where that very far away is by having either been there or been there through the imaginations of others. It's a very strange place. When you first arrive, if you do have an out-of-body experience in the astral world where you're conscious, and we all will when we die, this is for sure, but when you first arrive, people are grossly disoriented. Grossly. What they think they're perceiving is oftentimes incorrect. And they're easily duped in the lower astral subplanes by folks who want to get something from them. Usually it's some piece of their sense, because they'd rather use your sense than their own. Because you use up sense in the astral world, just like we use up food here, in a sense. And so it's a odd place. And it's not one to be messed with easily, because you could fall into all kinds of problems. At any rate, the fascinating thing about this is that we have a mental brain, an astral brain, and the astral brain takes all this information, which is highly complex, and is able to store it, and then it connects a feeling to what the information contains. And the feeling is what we use while we're physically alive to tell us about things. But we don't have the direct information coming from the astral world itself, unless a person, say, has a lower psychism and has some miswiring stuff, or if they have some kind of disease, including autism, and then they can have all kinds of strange kinds of results. And some of this information coming through while you're physically alive would not be helpful. And that's why people who are autistic, they can't, they're as confused here while part of their experience is coming from the astral world as we would be confused first going to the astral world and trying to understand what's going on around us. So they get equally confused, and it's very frustrating. All right, so let's continue on. The brain, the astral brain, is actually a more complex instrument than the physical brain, and it is unfortunately more easily damaged because it is more subtle. Now, what does subtle mean? It means that the amount of sensitivity to frequency and direction of frequencies or phase is and the intensity of any energy is extremely finely tuned to different changes. And here it's very gross. It's not so finely tuned. And so the astral brain, with its fine-tunedness, is great if you're living there and you can experience things at a much, much more subtle and even in-depth, more profoundly, we'll say, stimulating and informative ways in some things. At the same time, it's easily overloaded. And you sort of like, it's a trade-off. Yeah, you can deal with things more grossly, like we do in the physical world, but it's hard to overload the brain. Okay? The brain is kind of, I can deal with it, don't worry. But in the astral world, we can get overloaded pretty easily. And the intoxication and other elements of overloading leads to disorientation in odd ways. What does that mean? It means that people start losing pieces of their self almost instantaneously in any situation where they get overloaded. When you lose yourself, you start acting very primitive and childlike, and your behaviors become almost uncontrolled, and your desires take over. When this takes place, it's called glamoring. The desires become like a secondary brain and like a secondary almost thought device, and it's not even you anymore controlling you. And that's a scary thing. And this happens because of the nature of the astral brain itself. You know, I'd say, well, how come we don't just, if energy follows thought greater than sound and it really works that way in the astral world, why don't we just make our brains there more like our physical brains, so we don't get overloaded? Actually, some people do try that in a place called the fifth subplane, but it is not recommended, and it isn't good, because you lose the subtlety and the wonderment of an expansion in consciousness that comes from using the subtle, more subtle elements of the astral brain to be spiritual. So you actually go in the wrong direction spiritually, but you may make your physical brain more resistant, I mean not physical, your astral brain more resistant to overloading. And you may keep it from overloading as well by making an environment in which people don't stimulate it too much. And that's what the folks do, literally, in some parts of the fifth astral subworld. I can't fault them for it because in their value system, this is what makes sense to them. And in some ways, they're even saying to themselves, well, this is as virtuous as I can make myself. Because maybe it's true. Maybe they would be less virtuous if they just left themselves open to way people do this in a lower subworld where they become just victims continuously of excitement and other stuff around them. And, you know, so there's an argument to be made that maybe this is one of the steps that people have to take to eventually gain some self-control, because that's what we're talking about, self-control. And so this is a means. And it's sort of like a spiritual discipline in a sense, but it's based more on mundane reasons than for spiritual purposes. All right. So, that aside, we now move into, well, how does this link up then to the mental mind? Because we know there is a kind of composite of a mental mind in the astral body. Because the collection of the astral thought, which is creative imagination, does form a means of thinking, just the way in the physical body, the collection of physical brain thought creates a thing called coordination to the world around us, and allows us to use less energy to achieve certain activities. We do this naturally; we don't even tend to think about it, but we do that. But it isn't really, really thinking in the self sense. It's thinking more, again, subconsciously. And it might be something that is common to young children, but not something that we as adults would like to be the prominent issue in our life. We would like to think well beyond that. And we need then to have the lead in the mental body, which makes us human, so that the purposes and the creations that we make go far beyond just trying to stay alive or trying to conserve ourselves and our energy and our life energies. So this is the same in the astral body. And so what we call astral thought, which is creative imagination, is subservient, or it should be subservient, to the personality and itself in the lower and part of the higher mental body. And this actually works in some people this way. Their mental body tends to make decisions that are in accord with how they feel in some circumstances from the astral body and the creative imagination they use to help them to formulate an understanding of how people feel in general, and we'll call it the empathic approach to life. That all comes together from. But at the same time, the director of the whole situation is in the mental sphere, not the astral. Now, there is a problem, and that is that humans have, for themselves, created a dominance in the astral body called a kama, or emotional dominance, when too much of their glamours or desires that are fixed within their astral body take over. And when that starts happening, the thought of the mental body is short-circuited and it doesn't come through very well. And instead the person just says, gee, I want to eat a sundae right now, or I want to go and do this right now. I want to have sex. I want to have fun. I want to own it so I can feel good about something. I want to whatever. So these are the kinds of things that start to dominate the thought of the person with the astral body taking the lead. It's called kama-manasic thought. Now, why do we have this? Well, a prior race of people, the Atlanteans, in one of their sub-races, created this problem, and it now has become part of us. We, as individuals, have to break it rather than the race in its entirety will do so, because we can't as a race anymore. We're sort of like, we got it and it stuck with us. So we now have to do it on an individual level. Can it be done? Oh, sure. You just got to start saying something's more important than how you feel. Well, the only thing that really becomes more important to most humans than how they feel is how they feel about God. God can change the equation. And for people, when they have a spiritual life, they can start changing the kamo-manasic connection into a correctly designed system in which the manasic, or mental body, is always in the superior, or almost always in a superior position to the astral. And people's desires do not govern their behaviors. And we grow up and we stop being as egotistical. Now you say, well, I thought egotism is mental. It is, but it's defective mental. Egotism means that the mental body is not growing. And when it doesn't grow, it loses pace with the astral body and our desires. And then we can't control the astral body. So egotism leads to a lack of control of the astral body and to increases in kama manasic connection. Arrogance is much worse. Because arrogance now means you not only do things in an egotistical way in the mental body, but you keep it in step with the desires in your astral body. So the two become one and the same, and now you have a really dangerous person who not only doesn't think open-mindedly in terms of the mental body, but is also selfish in terms of the astral body to the point where they don't love others. So it's a kind of joining together anti-love with thinking you're always right and everyone else is always wrong. Not a good thing to have for a human. But a common problem, not as common as egotism, luckily, but arrogance can lead to evil. And it's a serious issue. All right, so now, looking at how this whole thing is coming together for us, okay, the astral brain is subtle and more prone to disease, in effect. And you want to hear something really weird? Most cancers, you know, we talk about cancer, don't come from a physical problem. About 10% come from the etheric world, which is the, you know, radioactivity, pollution, that sort of stuff. But 90% or so, for most people, of cancers come from desires which are turned on the self. Now, how does a desire turn on yourself? Most people have desires that want to aggrandize us and make us feel good, right? But if you get a desire where you feel very badly for having harmed other people, and that desire is to, in some way, like flog yourself or something, you know, in a totally, we'll call it, astral way. As this starts getting stronger and stronger, that sets up a whole bunch of serious changes that eventually can lead to a change in the physical body. It takes a long time for this to happen, months if not years, but it eventually leads to some of the more severe kinds of cancers. Where people actually are losing control over their physical body because they're trying so hard to keep in control their astral body, which is now turned on in on themselves, because effectively they're repressing guilt, they're repressing and denying the harm they keep causing to others. And this causes them to become lose control not only of their astral bodies, but then they lose control of their physical as well. Loss of control is the definition of, on a cellular level, of what's taking place with cancer. Cancer is a series of common cells that have adopted an anti-self nature. they no longer work for the collective good of the person as a self. They work for the common good of the glamours they're connected to in the astral body, if it's coming from that source. Or they work for the collective good of themselves in general because of etheric pollutions and other problems. And the results are they are damaged cells, obviously. But the stop signs that prevent them normally from doing this are removed genetically, and they live not for the nature of the body they're in, they live for the nature of the cellular mass they're a part of. Oof. Kind of goofy, huh? Yeah, it's a very primitive form of cell that's regressed from the human type of cell all the way back to virtually the most primitive form of cell life. Some of it colonizing in a way, but only for its own nature and not for the benefit of an organism. So it's anti-organistic other than for its own type. Okay, you're following that. And this can come from people with certain types of emotional issues. Okay, it can come from also arrogance. So arrogant people are also open to getting cancer, which is kind of an interesting point in itself. Okay, so getting, now I'm throwing in a lot of stuff, I know. Well, it makes it a little interesting. It isn't all just about the human mental body and mind, but it's about, we'll call it that. Now, back to where we're getting to, which is, how does this all connect together? Well, from each body's brain, information goes through a very strange process. There are connections from our soul that allows the three bodies to join together and to communicate with the mental brain and the personality, as well as with the lower self. But if the connection is not made by the soul and a thing called its alter ego or soul or angel, and also from a thing that helps create a soul, which is called a monad, it goes that far. If these things are not all connected together, a human being cannot be created. And this is, again, goes against some of the concepts in evolutionary theory, because humans are so very different from animals, because they come from an individual human soul, and the type of monad that they're connected to is also individually connected. So they have an individual nature, and they therefore function quite differently, and their minds work differently. The human mind has the capacity to improve itself at will. The will has to, though, connect eventually to the human soul. And this is a troublesome little issue for some people, because if you don't live virtuously enough, you are done after a certain point improving your mental mind. In other words, it's over. You can't improve it. You could improve it in ways to be destructive by joining with a group soul of evil, but you can't improve it in the sense of being non-destructive and creative and certainly virtuous unless you become more virtuous by thinking and adopting parts of yourself that are spiritual. You don't have to believe in a religion, but if you don't find God, however you define it, you can't grow your mind. I'm going to give you numbers now. I know this is going to be terrible. Some people are going to get upset about this. The maximum amount you can grow your mind is 8% of its potential, give or take. And most people are around a quarter of that or two. You can't grow your mind beyond 8% if you average it out between the three bodies. Now, I want you to understand something. The personality can grow the mind beyond that to somewhere in the neighborhood of 20%. There are differences between people. It could vary. Without there being much of a spiritual development in the person. But if you average it between the astral and the physical aspects, so a person can, if they're thinking purely mentally, they can try to segregate their mental thought from all else. And if they, and they're not trying to create anything, they're just trying to think, they could think up to 20% of their total capacity, give or take. But if you average it out, in a functional mode daily, they're not going to get much beyond 8%. And most people are stuck at around 2% of what I call the total consciousness factor, total amount of consciousness the person has. Whoa, these are pretty small numbers. And I'm not saying this to degrade or in some way make it sound like people are just, you know, like ants or something. But we're very far from the improvement and perfection of the mental, body, and mind. And I need to make that point clear right from the get-go, because a lot of people that haven't done a lot of soul-searching, literally, and a lot of work on themselves in spiritual discipline-wise, think their mental development is far greater and consciousness is far greater than what it really is. As a matter of fact, one of the typical signs of a person who is relatively low in consciousness is they think it's fair. They think they're very conscious. All right, so that's kind of like part of the problem, if you want to call it that. Okay, and now, and the interesting thing is until you get to about 4%, you're not critical, self-critical enough to know that you're so low. As you get over about 4% or about twice the average of where people are in general, people start realizing how low their consciousness is. I know. That's really weird. Huh? And so most people have no clue how low their consciousness is. They don't. And it's just the way of it. You know, now, this is not a criticism. And I don't want you to think that, oh, he's thinking he's really tough stuff. I'm not comparing myself to other people here. I'm talking about it strictly in terms of numerical values so other people, all of you listening, can start getting a semblance of the realities that we live within. It is most difficult to have your mental body functioning high while you're physically alive because the physical body pulls you way down. Trying to be fully conscious in the physical world is very, very difficult because it takes so much from us to raise our consciousness in a physical sense. Physical consciousness is the ability to coordinate ourselves so well with everything that we use less and less energy to achieve the same results and eventually less and less time. So time and space are moving together while we make less quote-unquote mistakes, and we use very little energy, we also age slower. So all of that takes place in the physical world, but it is the most difficult place to do it, and it pulls us down in terms of our total consciousness, because this is all coming together. We are not just a physical being. We're a physical, astral, lower and higher mental being, and a few what people are actually into the Buddhic realm. But it is a those things are, those higher parts of us, only really count if we're physically alive when we are spiritually disciplining ourselves in the physical world. So be aware of that. And very few people are. And very few of the few people who are, even fewer of them succeed all that often. Okay, so now we start beginning to see the nature of the problem here. Of improving ourselves is that you have to spiritually discipline yourself in each of the bodies to achieve a result in total mental, body, and mind advancement. And this is the reason that this thing called synthetic yoga doesn't work unless somebody is doing it. If someone is not physically and astrally, spiritually disciplining themselves, no matter what kind of mental discipline they're applying in a yoga, which could be very advanced, they're going to be tripped up by lower consciousness in the other bodies averaging out and actually creating heat, which is wasted energy, in the mental body, which could damage the mental body. Because if you think that the astral mind is subtle, the mental brain and mind is more so. So the mental mind can even be further damaged, particularly by trying to be spiritually ambitious and to discipline it when you're not disciplining the astral and physical to at least the same extent, if not more. This is what was discovered in attempting to use this very advanced mental yoga, that people were literally creating mental problems for themselves. Really. And in addition, losing the ability, not gaining it, to astrally and physically discipline themselves. Holy cow, what are you talking about? Backfire. All because they didn't start with the right ingredients to begin with, a balanced spiritual nature, which is that the physical, astral, and mental bodies are at least spiritually disciplined around the same amount. Now, what is spiritual discipline? It means that you limit most of your other senses to improve one of the seven that are conscious and within your control at a time, and then eventually two, and eventually three. But you start with just one, and as they improve, you move on to the next one and try and balance them so that each one is working about at the same level of competency. So the information you're receiving through the senses is accurate to about the same level from sense to sense in the same body, and then eventually between each body. You keep these equal, and then even if you're lower than someone else, if you're better balanced, you'll have better results. So being really high in a body is not necessarily that's going to work all that well for you, and can lead. It won't stay that way either. It could lead to a actual destruction of the senses to some degree, and even worse, the brain and that body. Damage to it can occur. I've seen it happen. It also works its way into the lower body. So someone could develop senility, who is very brilliant in some respects in the mental body, but they don't exercise very much discipline physically or astrally. And now that's an ingredient, if they start using an advanced technique like synthetic yoga, to destruction. Yeah, and if they're egotistical, they may not listen to someone telling them that they shouldn't do that. So you can see how this is a real big danger. And as a result of this, the people that can, have experimented with this have agreed not to reveal the information of how to do this stuff, because it's dangerous. Too many people will use it wrong and will create wrongly and will create a destruction for themselves. We don't want that. That's not a good thing. Now, at some point, there'll be enough spiritually disciplined people in a balanced way that this sort of thing could be very helpful. It could save lifetimes of development. And what we're going to eventually be talking about in the next hour or so is this improvement in perfecting, and it can, which normally has taken literally a dozen or more lifetimes, in some cases dozens of lifetimes, and change it into one or two or three. Ooh, yeah, serious stuff. Really, and so tonight's show is really about quantum leaps in improvement. That's what we're going to try to get to. So I'm encouraging you for the next hour to stay tuned in, because I know, you've been on for how long? Oh, don't worry, it'll go fast. All right, so we're getting some of the basics down. We're starting to see why things work the way they work. And have I ever done a show like this before? Vaguely, but not to this level. I doubt that in the past, the audiences that I have had would have been able to sustain this. And also, I wasn't on long enough. So, in the first show, and you can't go a week later and come back. Nobody remembers. just doesn't work that way. It's one of the perplexities of being on a weekly basis. Even the next day would be bad enough. Imagine 7 days, you know. Okay. Can you remember what you were doing 7 days ago? Well, you might be listening to me, but other than that, say tomorrow, could you remember what you were doing a week ago, Saturday? Yeah, I'm asking about the general idea. Well, I think I went here and did that. But a lot of the specifics gone, right? All right, here we go. Let's try to get this thing all together so we can then talk about the improvements. All right, so we have connections. Now, the connections go through, not through the personality, not through the lower self. The connections all go through the soul, the solar angel, and a thing called the monad, which is like a super part of the soul. The soul is created by the monad. Okay? And the monad is mostly there to maintain the element of life itself. The soul is there, the human soul is there, to create mental understanding of God. Mental understanding of God, leading eventually into Buddha. But for most human beings, we can call it mental. That's what the soul's job is. I want you to understand God. Here's God. This is what God does. This is who God is. That sort of stuff. And then that's the same for the solar angel. The solar angel is helping our soul because our soul doesn't know all the answers. The solar angel then comes in and helps. Solar angel is also our conscience. Everyone has at least one connection with the solar angel through the conscience. Now you could say, well, do we all have connections to the human soul? If you've been around for dozens to hundreds of lifetimes, yes. If you just dropped in for the first time, no. So a brand newbie, which there are very few of them these days, a brand new soul that has not incarnated on this planet before a human being, that soul is going to create a human being that is going to have very little connection to its own soul because there's an energy field around the soul composed of, yeah, you got it, the lotus, the petals of this energy field all around it that gives it the ability to understand God. And it's the senses of the soul itself in the higher mental world. And those senses supply it with understandings of God that are way beyond the understandings that humans have. But believe it or not, only one little piece of that energy field is open when the very first human is created, and that's the one that humans use, mostly, unfortunately, for the first dozen or more lifetimes, to create an understanding of, on a knowledge-based level, of the world around them without a spiritual understanding of God very deep. They usually have a conscience, and they usually may have some sense, small sense of God, coming from their heart and crown chakras in their physical astral, in what we call the mental chakras. But what they don't have is a coordination of these two centers, and they don't have very well-developed chakras in those areas. So very little information comes through, therefore, without the information, they can't create new knowledge. Without the knowledge, they can't come to a higher level of consciousness. So this is where the soul, the human soul, has to develop itself. And it does so a little bit at a time, one lifetime to the next. And most humans are way behind. Most humans have had hundreds of lifetimes. And so they do have a lot of direct contact with their soul, and also they still have the conscience with the solar angel, but they may have also other connections with the solar angel. Now, this is interesting. As these connections develop with the solar angel, it's called a rainbow bridge. It's like fields of energy moving from one part of the soul to the solar angel and then to the personality and the self and then back to the point. So it's all getting connected together, but it's also connecting down into the lower bodies. Most people don't know this. Through a couple of fields that are created by the soul called the consciousness stream and another part, some people call it the citrat, and another part going to the from the monad that is life itself. The life one is very interesting because this life part that connects to the centers in the lower bodies, when it is matured through the crown and heart chakras, the way it's matured is instead of just wanting to stay alive, we want to live our life to create more of life that is like God, making ourselves and everything else around us godly or virtuous, enlightened. And when we seek that for others, especially, that particular vibration of life energy, life force, changes us into what is called gradually into monadic creative consciousness. And we start to create God here, where we are living in the physical world and eventually in the astral and in the middle. That becomes the focus of our life. Now, it doesn't mean we become ministers or something like that. That's a religious issue. This is about consciousness. This is about changing our consciousness from being about our lower selves to being about something called the higher self, which is really the self of the solar angel. So we adopt and join part of the solar angel as our self, which connects most strongly, not with just our soul, it does connect with the soul, but with our monad. And we become super creative. And the greatest creators in the world are people who are monadically infused. Now, there's only two categories of monadically infused people. They are people who are at the accepted stage of the first and second initiation. I'm not going to explain too much of what that means, but for the people who do know, that will help them. And then people who have reached the point where they have done the renunciations of the third initiation and gone beyond that. They become totally infused with monadic creative energies, become super creative. All arhats fall into this category, and advanced level, third level initiates do as well to some extent. The third level initiates think it, but they don't do it. They don't live it. Whereas the arhat thinks and actually goes and does it. Now, they may be frenetic, and the others don't usually keep up with what they're doing, but the point is they are doers, whereas the third level initiates are more thinkers. Sometimes the most they do is maybe talk and sometimes write or communicate in some way the ideas they have, but they don't exactly live it per se, and living it is the big deal. Living the virtue that you create in a mental sense is more difficult, of course, and there's more room for failure. But it changes the world much more rapidly, and it has a profound effect on those people who are usually students of people who are doing certain things. Those people that are monadically infused are either leaders or teachers, big teachers, usually. So those are the two categories. They're leaders if they're in the first or second initiation and at the accepted stage, or they're a sort of big teacher if they're a third-level initiate at the stages past the renunciations, and particularly if they're at the accepted stage of the third initiation, then they become both a combination kind of leader-teacher, sort of speaking, but they don't become a true big teacher, really big teacher, until they give up the leading role and become an arhat. That's when they become most creative, but then their creations are no longer up to themselves, but up to their students. And that becomes a tremendous sacrifice on the part of the monadically infused. But it's exactly what the monad did to begin with. You become the monad because the monad says, I'm not going to go and live life lower than in the monadic realm, which is very, very high in dimensionality from where we are. I'm going to create life just the way God created me here, so that life can create more in the lower realms, and I won't interfere with that. And so that's what Narhat is doing. He's replicating, or she's replicating, monadic infusion. Wow. Big deal, right? Yeah, it's sort of a big deal. It's a big sacrifice because the human side of us always wants to get something for our efforts. And the Arhat gets the opposite. They usually get killed or in some way pay a great penalty for their efforts. Go figure. All right, no, but it's a test. It's a test to make sure, because these people are becoming superhuman. So before they can become superhuman and exercise such extreme powers that superhumans might have, abilities we call it, before they do that, they must show the ability to not use this under the most adverse circumstances. And so they're put into very adverse circumstances. Kind of an interesting thing. Okay, so looking at improving ourselves, we want to be monadically infused, but the monadic infusion process creates creation, and it makes us super creative. And the other side of it, in terms of our soul development, makes us super conscious and very loving. But not loving in the way that it's sappy or sentimental, but rather in a way in which the love is to help others to become more loving in a wise way themselves. Wise loving means giving in ways that always serves others for the benefit of everyone else, not just for the individual. If you give, even if it really makes one person much better, but it detracts from their ability to help others to do the same, that's unwise giving. Unwise giving always results in very poor outcomes with lots of destructive elements and bad karma. So, and the karma gets worse the more you're supposed to be capable, the wiser you should be able to be, and you aren't. So that's when the karma gets really serious. All right, so looking at how this whole system is working now, the improvement of the human mind contingent upon all of the elements that I have so far discussed in this show, and no small set of criteria or ideas to look at here, in that this is one heck of a ride going from one place, 2% in consciousness, to eventually 100% in consciousness. Yeah, a 98% improvement. From what is the average consciousness of a person in this world as we are today. Whew. Now, the 2% is dragged down, and I'll agree to this, by the fact that we are physically alive. It goes way up. It instantly hits 4% on average for people that get to the astral world. It virtually doubles. It really does, especially if you deal with time. When they first arrive in the astral world, it could be 2.5% or something. But within a few decades of our time there, not our time here, but our time there, when we're alive there, the improvement can quickly get up to, say, 3.5%, 4%. Once it does about reach 4%, people can start making choices more, because they identify with the fact that they're not very conscious. We're starting to exercise more spiritual discipline in their life. And that leads to all kinds of wonderful changes in people who live in the astral world, because they usually advance themselves more rapidly than they would have been in the physical world. And they may eventually devote themselves to leading a spiritual life, which is a big deal. Then they might eventually grow to that 8% level. That's a biggie, because when you get to that level, you usually are working with others in a group conscious fashion. You may be part of a group at a 4% level, but not work together very well. But at 8%, it really starts coming together, and people do a much better job. And that's a good thing. Now, what about this business about the mental side of non-spiritual thought? Well, that grows too. And in the astral world, there's a place called the third subworld, where it can get up to beyond 50%. But spiritually, they don't get much beyond that. That's the problem. You see, they value one over the other, and they still have a lot of egotism. It isn't that they're not spiritual. Some of them get to 50% in consciousness, but then grow beyond that, but get to 75% in their ability to actually think for a while. And even have moments where they might be 75% conscious, but it doesn't last because, unfortunately, they aren't willing to sacrifice some of the mundane elements of being able to think in a mental way for the sake of being more spiritual. It's a rude way to understand through the difficulties that this presents for humans that eventually we have to make a choice. And the choice is to not individually become greater so that others can improve themselves. Now, a lot of people are going to say, hey, but you were talking about social justice being wrong and we shouldn't give to people blankly. But yeah, it's okay to give to people mentally and help them in wise ways mentally and even astrally. What I said is you can't give it to them physically. If you physically give to people redistributing wealth, what you do is you make them more selfish. You lower the impetus for them to use their spiritual aspects to develop their mind and their astral bodies. And instead, they become more selfish and more, we'll say, lacking in creativity. That's the problem. So we don't get confused by the issues here. There's a huge difference between how you grow the mental body and how you grow the astral and the physical body and their minds, or the mind portion that is created by the thinking apparatus. The real mind is always in the mental sphere, because a human mind is a mental mind. These other minds that we have, so to speak, are just composites of the thoughts and the way we think in those bodies. It isn't like the kind of mind that gives self-development. There is no self-development without there being commensurate mental development. Just that's the reason one-year-olds don't have a self to speak of. If you remember that from the beginning of the show, that's the proof of it, actually. That gives you an idea of why it's true. You can see this in this respect. So do not get confused about that, because it's a big deal. There's a lot of hype being suggested that is the antithesis of truth. In other words, it's lies. And a lot of it is based upon the need to control and power being influenced over other people through propaganda and lies and force and that sort of stuff. All right, so back again to the question of how do we improve this? What are we going to do now? And the first part of it is the development of virtue in the lowest body first instead of last. How do you develop virtue in your physical body? Well, you use the physical body in the most efficient way possible. That in some way helps others to do the same. That does not come from giving everybody half your money. Don't even consider it. That's the opposite of what the result will be. You'll make them more selfish, less creative, and the whole thing falls apart. What it does mean is that you create new ways that help people to become more creative themselves. You help them to exercise their creativity, help them to exercise becoming more cooperative and giving in that way, and to work together with others. You design systems so other people can, if they choose to, work with you in them. This is a great thing. I do this virtually every day of my life. Sometimes I succeed, more often I fail, not because necessarily I'm terrible at it, but because the systems I'm designing are more advanced ones, and a lot of the people that enter into them find them too challenging. And so the failure is that they don't succeed. The good part is I challenge them to the point where it moves their consciousness from 2% closer to 4%, where they recognize that they have to grow more in their failures, from their failures. So there's a method to my madness. I'm not just doing it so people can fail. I'm doing it so they can eventually succeed. But this is the way of the world. We need to recognize these ways that have been done for a long time, eons and eons, by great ones that are beyond human. And they are, again, the antithesis of socialism, communism, and all that crap. They are the way of the wise and the conscious, superconscious, and the loving in a universal sense. Okay. So that's the first thing. We need to allow ourselves the room to be creative and to, at the same time, challenge our environment. The things that prevent us from doing that are fear. Fear of loss of material things. Fear of loss of material control. Fear of chastisement and the way people think of us or consider us in various issues. Fear of loss of relationships and closeness to us. Fear of death. These are the elements that keep people from, and fear of not being right all the time for people who are egotistical, which a lot of people are. So these are the elements that bring us into failure in terms of developing coordinated responses to everything around us so that we use the least amount of energy and intelligently coordinate ourselves with everything and everyone, so that we take the least amount of time and create the least amount of space between us and everything else. The least amount of time to do whatever we're doing with the least amount of effort. Got it? It's called effortlessness, and it's also service to others. So a lot of people say what you're doing in the physical body, to begin with, is called effortless service. Okay? Eventually, we're going to work on the astral body and do similar. The astral body has this subtlety and the refinement. There we're trying to develop a thing called super empathy. Now, what is super empathy? Well, let's talk about what empathy is. Empathy is the ability to know how people, in a mundane sense, are feeling in themselves by us using our senses to know what their feelings are. Okay, that's empathy. Now, super empathy is knowing how much people are or are not feeling God, as well as knowing how much we feel of God in the heart and crown chakras. And that's in all three bodies, by the way, not just the astral body. And when we have that super empathy, we can join those bodies together in ourselves and help others to do so in themselves, because the three bodies are joined by God. Remember that? They're not joined, they can't be joined by the personality, they can't be joined by the lower self, only by what I call God, which is represented by our soul, our solar angel, or, you know, some people call it the inner guide, or I don't care what name you call it, it's this energy being that helps our soul, and our monad. Those are all elements of God to us. God is something even greater than that, and you can experience God in everything beyond those elements that I just mentioned. But within ourselves, those things are always available. And when we connect ourselves through those things, we connect the three bodies together. So you're going to see that as you discipline each body individually, you're also starting to join that body with the other two so that it's balancing. You must balance the bodies as you develop them. If you develop one body to the exclusion of the other two, or two to the exclusion of the third, the result is the whole thing collapses. And you will eventually, will become selfish and dark in some ways, but you may also lead yourself strangely into the door of evil. So this is scary stuff if you don't do this right, so please pay attention. Okay. So you want to discipline the astral body one sense at a time. And when you get one sense going there, and you got one sense in the physical body, and you try to join those two together. Then you do the same with the mental body, one sense at a time. Now, the mental body senses, I don't think I have enough time to go into each one and define it. You can look it up. It's part of Chapter 7 in Life and Meaning, or you can look it in some other books written by other people. But the book I wrote is more well-defined, especially about the mental senses. But anyway, these mental senses correspond to the same senses we have in the other bodies, but they work in a different way, and they have more definition of dimensionality because they include all three parts of time in every part of the other dimensionalities that are available in the astral and physical world. So, yes, you still have the direction and the intensity of energy. That's clear. The intensity of energy becomes more understandable in the mental body than it is in the astral, because you include all three parts of time as the fifth dimension in the mental body. Time is a whole. So whenever you experience a dimension, height, width, and depth, added with the direction and intensity of energy, those four dimensions, when you ever experience that, in the mental body, you experience it not only in the past and the present, as you would in the astral body, but you experience it also as it will be or could be in the future. The whole dimension of time changes everything because it adds wisdom and truth to the development of understanding or consciousness. And everything now changes for a person in improving themselves. Because once you develop that part, the integration of the mental body to the other two at the same level of sense development, and sense development, again, is using the sense for what? For the creation of more of the creator in yourself and in others. That's what you're doing. Then you reach a point where when you put the three together, you become a quote-unquote super creator. And you're either a great leader and or a great teacher with a big T. Now, when that sort of thing takes place, you are greatly improving the overall mental function, because you, in simultaneous terms, are joining the three bodies together into one. And when you do that, time shortens for the ability to think. Remember, when the bodies are separated, thought has to go from one to the other, back and forth, and huge amounts of time are used to create thought. Now, let me give you some numbers so you can understand this. Normally, people think about, when they're dominated in their physical body by selfishness, they think at about the speed that the mental brain can think. How fast is that? Okay. Let's put it again at around the 2% level of the brain's capacity. But it's because mostly we're just thinking so much separated from our mental apparatus. Not because there's something wrong with our physical, although the physical is certainly improved by physical discipline, if it's spiritual. Now, you can think better by disciplining the physical body non-spiritually. Oh, you could go to these sites, brain gems, and all this other stuff. You can do that. You might increase it a little bit, too, that way. But the big quantum leaps come when you start doing this for the co-creation with and for God in yourself and others. Wow, that's the big deal. And that's what we've been talking about now, for the improvement part. Okay, so look at how this is starting to come together for us. If we don't separate the time and space between the bodies and the dimensions the bodies function in, the time in which it takes to think is cut down by a factor of, are you ready for this? At least, no less than about 90 times. In reality, most people experience it in the hundreds of times as they get better at it. And if you don't think it means something, just think that fast. Wait till you get there. Now, there are some frustrations with this. Because let's say you're really good at it, and you've worked on discipline, you've got all seven senses in each of the three bodies improved by, say, 50%. Many, many times more than that, but by 50% of the maximum capacity. If you reach that kind of level, which is like 25 times more than what people normally think, right, in terms of time variation, and you're not thinking through and with each body, you're hundreds of times faster than in total thought faster. The world around you seems to be moving slower. There's a frustration level that you will definitely hit fairly quickly, actually, within months, actually, of doing this process, because everybody around you seems to be thinking slower and slower. That's not, of course, true. It's not at all true. It's a relative thing. Your mind is perceiving that, but it's not the truth. The truth is, it's your own mind that is speeded up. And I'm not talking about speeded up like, oh, man, I'm having a hug, I'm taking amphetamines. No, I'm talking the opposite. Clarity. Speeded up with increased clarity and consciousness. Now, what's it like to think hundreds of times faster? Well, the mental mind becomes more and more a tool than the drudgery that is experienced by most other people. Most people, when they try to think, they're frustrated by the ability to keep the thought in their mind even long enough to join it with something else. To the person thinking hundreds of times faster and who's spiritual now, they're able to join together these thoughts so quickly that there is virtually no labor. There isn't this frustration of one thought to the next, and then you can barely do it, and then you forget this and that. That's all gone. All that disappears. And a clarity comes of hundreds and eventually thousands of concepts able to be held together at the same time in a second or less about whatever the person chooses to think about. I don't know if this is making sense to some people, because a lot of people are saying, huh? Because, again, this is not a traditional or accepted human condition. People don't think that that's being human. I'm saying it is being human, but it's the improved state. Okay? And in the improved state, this is where human beings are meant to go to. Now, when are we going to get there as the whole race? I'm afraid that could be certainly much more than a few centuries and probably a few millennia to get to where the whole, you know, on an average, the whole race is in the kind of thing. And egotism has to be overcome. Common monastic connection has to be broken. And we've got to reach this level that the balance is maintained, too. Now, if you do balance this, something magical happens. It's called two things happen. First, you elevate and raise what is known as the three kundalinis, which helps to unify and join the senses in each body and then between the bodies, as well as long as you're using your mental capacity and joining it through the spiritual channels of the monad, soul angel. That triad is bringing it together. And you're getting you're getting a much more bigger bang for your buck, so to speak, in having done your spiritual discipline once you get the balance, because the bodies are able to be joined together through this these three kundalinis coming up. You get into this thing. Can the three kundalinis be balanced? Yes, they can be controlled and balanced. We're going to get to that in the perfecting part. We're almost there. But in the beginning, no. The kundalinis are rather helter-skelter, and they do not, by definition, balance themselves without active conscious control coming from the soul. So the personality and lower self cannot deal with kundalini energy any more than it can deal with any of the super things that go on in that sphere that it does inhabit but doesn't have much understanding. So when we reach the point of balance of the seven centers, reasonable balance, it's not perfect, but reasonable balance, and we start using this for the purposes of creating super thoughts, hundreds, thousands of concepts brought together, sort of a new synthesis of ideation is brought into the world, and it's creating more, co-creating and creating more with God. Then, and helping others, of course, to do that. Then, at that point, the three bodies begin to start vibrating in a new vibration. Now, I don't want to get into, you know, some kind of a song here. I'm thinking about great vibrations or something. But it is a new type of vibration energy together that joins the solar angel part of itself, it has three parts, with the soul and the, we'll say the monad. It's a little different than just talking about the monad because it's really, we'll say the monadic element. And so when this takes place, the process, because there's really more than one monad involved, because there's a monad that is connected to, in fact, the solar angel. That's why it's not this power monad. And so when this starts to take place, the improvement is much more rapid, and a completion of something called the rainbow bridge, which I mentioned earlier, is done. The three sides of it are done. And then it's just a matter of switching the thinking apparatus from the where the soul is located, which is in the second sub, the fourth subplane of the second subplane of the higher mental world, to the fifth subplane of the Buddhic world, which is the top of what's called the rain cloud of noble things. And people are going, huh? Okay, no, it's just, let's talk about it like this. Let me talk about it in terms of functionality. The thought of us becomes the thought of our soul. We and the soul become one in thinking. And I talk about soul, I'm talking about the solar angel as well. And that thought is now elevated into the Buddhic realm, which is part of the solar angel's realm, but it is not part of our soul. The soul now is getting connected to a higher source itself, again, through the efforts of the human. The soul does its own part, but basically it is the human that is doing this. That's the hard thing to imagine. And once we start initiating Buddhic thought from this place, the Buddhic thought is now is 100 times faster than the highest mental thought, which is now thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of times faster than the average human being. Okay. So what is that like? Well, now you have a thing called controlled intuition. Now, instead of having parts of a whole idea coming together through five concepts from here, four concepts from there, three from another place, which still is faster than taking one at a time, which might take you years, if not the whole lifetime, to come up with a real idea. Now, within about less than an hour time, 1 to 2 seconds, tens of thousands of concepts are brought together and balanced at one time. Balanced. And they can be transmitted to a thing called white magic. Oh, boy. Through the three bodies and used to create teaching, used to create new things, even technologies, anything imaginable you can create, including using the imagination in the process. And when this takes place, you know, a person is physically alive, that person becomes a super genius, and, you know, they can do a lot of amazing things. But the most important part about improving the mental mind is the mental mind no longer becomes the originating source of the concepts. This is a little hard for people to understand because we think in terms of mental concepts, human beings do, but you can improve your mental mind so that you don't use the mental body to create the concepts, only to individually separate them if needed, such as if you're teaching or if you have to use it to develop a whole series of system designs for some new project or something, even human systems or whatever. You can do it that way, but you do it, the mental body becomes an instrument and not the source of mind. The mind moves from the mental body itself. Remember, the mind, well, actually, we haven't defined it completely, have we now? Let's do that. The mind, the mental mind, is the source of all creative thought until the mind is moved to the Buddhic body. And as that takes place, the Buddhic body becomes the source of all creative thought. And the mental body becomes only an instrument of communicating it to humans. And interestingly, the Buddhic body communicates with those that are superhuman. Yeah. So the Buddhic body is used to communicate with superhumans and vice versa. Superhumans can communicate with the human. Once they get their mind into the Buddha body, it's called controlled intuition. And the mental body then becomes available to use as a tool or communication device with human beings. The reason this is so good is because you're then, once you're in that vein, you're open-minded completely, egotism is zero, and your mental senses are only used for the service of others in some way or other. Whew. That service is godliness. That's what God is. It's spiritual service and being God, same thing. So you're now a co-creator with God. And that's what you're here for. And this is the form of improvement. The whole process is in this. In the beginning, it develops through uncontrolled intuition. Brief fractions of a second to a few seconds of being flooded with a bunch of concepts from the Buddhic body, but not being able to hold it long enough to probably process it and to use it as a big teacher, maybe a little teacher. You might get some kick out of that. And then sometimes coming up with a piece of an idea, a partial idea, it works for that too. But the whole idea and the whole idea and teaching for as long as you want to teach for without stumbling or anything, that is the higher element. That comes from controlled intuition, not uncontrolled. And once you can control it, that means now you have a thing called omniscience. The omniscience is shared, it's a shared state, with all other beings that are now their superhuman beings who can communicate with the still human. The human might be partially superhuman, but they're still considered human. And they can start developing this, we'll say, shared ability to bring in whatever all-knowingness or omniscience into any circumstance in which it's necessary to create for the sake of being enlightened or helping others to become enlightened. And this is the process that is used. Now, to be careful about what we're saying here, you can't use this process to gain anything for the lower self. As a matter of fact, if that's even attempted, the lower mind is immediately burned, and destruction can prevail. And as a matter of fact, you can't do it for the help of other people's lower self. Same, it doesn't matter if your lower self or anyone else's lower self. So you have to let people fail in their lower selves rather than help their lower self. Because if you try to help people for their lower self purposes, you burn your own mind out. And so there's severe consequences for using this system wrongly. Again, this relates to synthetic yoga in a lot of ways, too. So it's a very interesting process. And the improvement element is big. So once you get to point where you get to the top of the rain cloud and noble things, which is on the fifth Buddhic subplane, then at that point you can control how much omniscience you need to use in a particular situation. The difference between the fifth and the fourth Buddhic subplane, where masters are, where people who are no longer human, period, is it's just this one subplane, is that on the fourth Buddhic subplane, the balance of the thoughts becomes so great that the human personality no longer manifests itself as a separate part of the human. The human personality joins with the soul, and the self, the lower self, completely joins with this higher self of the solar angel. And then at that point, the person is no longer a person, but they are a superhuman. And so they're not a person because the personality is not separated from the soul. That's the main thing. Person is the son of the soul separated from the soul, and personality is the person exercising itself separate from the soul. Once the soul person is joined with the soul, the personality and soul don't really exist as separate beings. They exist just as the soul. And remember, the soul and the solar angel are also joined together. So you get all this coming together, this stuff. And it allows the prior human to raise themselves to the fourth Buddhic subplane, where they are omniscient all the time, whether they are in an active state of service or what is known as the passive state of service. So humans can only be actively in a state of service and have omniscience, whereas superhumans can be passively in service and still maintain omniscience. Now, what does that mean? Well, once you're passively in service, you are always connected to all other super beings, whereas if you're actively in service, only connecting you, because you're only on the fifth Buddhic subplane, you only connect with the other super beings while you're actively serving, but you're not connected with them any other way. Once you reach the higher level, that connection gives you a new sense of both individuality, strangely. You are uniquely more part of a greater whole, and then at the same time, your soul becomes much bigger because it is permanently connected to all of the souls. It's no longer just separate. It's more individual, but more connected to every other soul. It's a little hard to understand that concept. You can read about it in Chapter 6 about souls and life and meaning. But regardless, so now we're finally at that point where we're talking about perfection. Once we have reached the fourth Buddhic subplane in consciousness, and can maintain it there for more than a few seconds. I'm not saying that a human couldn't get there and maintain it for a few seconds. I'm talking about living there. If you can live there, then you're a superhuman. You no longer have an isolated personality from your soul. You don't have an isolated lower self. All that stuff's gone. You are in initiations. You're at the fifth initiation. You have become a fifth level initiate in today's standards. That, again, it may not be relevant to everybody, but for the few people who understand that, it's fine. I'll let you know about that. The critical part of this perfection is that the mind has a totally new reference. The mind's reference now, being in the fourth Buddhic subplane, is that it lives in a state of bliss and beauty. Not joy. Joy happens when you get to the fifth, that's for sure. But bliss and beauty have a new element to existence in them, because all of what used to be the astral sensations of joy and love become a universal love and become a state of continuous joy that never varies. It just is continuous. It varies only over very long periods of time as all of a planet develops, all of humanity develops, all of life develops, that sort of thing. And also, the perspective of a super being of this type is that the mind is now starting to join with the mind of beings, not just in this world, Earth in this case, but it starts to have connections to other planets and other worlds where life exists, some of which doesn't exist in physical form, but in other forms. So it's important to realize that this is a major step. When you perfect the human mind, it is no longer human, and you don't have a human being anymore. So this is the methodology to becoming superhuman, or ascension of some people's phraseology, although that to me means something else too, but it's becoming superhuman. And it's becoming a living soul. That's another way of looking at it. It obliterates, though, the concept of the need for humanness. The reason it obliterates it is because humanness is the development of soul by separation. And you move from that state of development to the development of soul by joining. Now, a lot of people that I've known and some that I've read about have questioned, why can't you just develop the soul by joining in the first place? Why do we need this human thing going on? And that's because of the lower kingdoms. The job of the human is not just to elevate themselves. It's to elevate the lower kingdoms that eventually become within their own control and to learn how to overcome and defeat the nemesis of all humanity, which is evil. Evil only comes from and only is a part of other, well, I shouldn't say only, but it's mostly a part of humanity. Humanity can make some lower forms of life evil, but that's a reflection of the evil in humanity. And evil does not exist above the human kingdom. So humans are there for these reasons. Humans are there to develop the three lower worlds, to do so in a way that complements God without God intervening and making a puppet show, so we have free will. And we're allowed to be creative and make mistakes and do all the things we do, and even to become evil. But at the same time, we are here to overcome evil. And what is evil? Evil is the desire to be God in the reverse of its role. God's role is to create life so it can create itself. Evil's role is to destroy life so it can destroy God. So you see, it's a whole other bag. And if you live for evil, you live for the eventual destruction of everything, including yourself. Although evil does not understand that. I've even had discussions with evil about that. So I know it doesn't understand it. So the odd thing about it is it's a weird situation. You're in a weird situation. Evil is here on Earth right now, and it is having a field day. But be aware that the process of moving from a human to a superhuman involves this whole mental body mind thing. And if we could get past some of the problems that presently exist in this world, propaganda and egotism, arrogance, and all the stuff that is happening, and the truthful is really just dissolving away before us, that sort of thing is where we have to put the fight into. You have to say the truth, you have to be the truth, you have to live the truth, no matter what the consequences. The more you do that, the more you're doing the right thing, even though there may be some severe consequences. Evil looks and hunts out people who do that. Okay, so how do you manage, then, the total perfection with all these forces against you? Because eventually you have to be in a force-less condition. The service of a master of the Ageless Wisdom is of creating an effortless service through Buddhic consciousness or higher. And in order to reach these places, we do it, humans do it, through sacrifice, which is spiritual discipline, and a level of consciousness which gets up to at least double what the present level is in this world at this time. There were times when it was different and different issues, but that's where it is today. That's your minimum. You got to fight to reach the point where you realize you're not very conscious. And then once you get there, you can start really doing something to change it. And what is that called? What is that fight called? Well, that fight of going from the 2 to the 4% is developing a thing called humility. Humility is what is lacking in people who think that they're more conscious than they really are. Humility is the person who admits to mistakes almost immediately after making them, and when confronted with any level of truth beyond what they have created in themselves and have done so in others, they grasp onto the higher truth. These are the people who are humble. And the people who believe they're spiritually humble are usually the ones who have no sense of what it is at all. So the really humble people recognize their lack of humility and challenge themselves to develop more. This process is so vast from where most people are at that it may be lifetimes before they reach even the slightest element of humility throughout most of their life. But it is important and critical. And for all of us, we can actually strive for both humility and the sacrifice necessary to do spiritual discipline and reach much greater states of being closer to God. You cannot do it for spiritually ambitious reasons. You can't do it because you want to be a master. You can't do it because you want to live someplace other than the three lower worlds. You can't do it because you want other people to recognize how great you are. Or you can't do it because you want to even think you're great yourself. All those ways will defeat the goal. And what is the goal? The goal is to become a co-server with God, and in so doing, help everyone else that you know and have any ability to be of service to do so themselves. If that's where you're coming from, tonight's show is going to make a big difference to you. If it isn't where you're coming from, tonight's show probably, well, you're probably not listening anymore anyway. So here's the point. We all have a great opportunity to not only improve ourselves, but eventually to perfect ourselves. If you're listening to the show and you've made it this far, you're probably within a couple dozen or so lifetimes from perfected. Really? You're that close? Probably. You're certainly within 40 or 50. And maybe a lot less. And so, yes, you've been around a long time. Hundreds and hundreds of lifetimes, probably way past 600, maybe past 700. And so you've got all kinds of possibilities. And maybe you're past, even past 750. I know there's this magic number, 777, but that's just an odd number. Somewhere around 700 to 800 lifetimes, people make the choice to move in this direction. And when they do, their life changes dramatically. If you do, and if you choose to follow some of the guidelines of tonight, you will undoubtedly have more questions. I suggest that you read some of the things that I've written, listen to some of the other shows I've done, and you can call me, you can Skype me, you can write me, you can do whatever you want to communicate, and I'll help you. Yeah, no kidding. And no charge. So the object here is that if you want, you have a great deal of resources. But those resources, again, are only available to those who are doing the things that I talked about in tonight's show. I will help, but I won't give to people who only want to take or fill up my time and space with telling me how great they are. That is not going to be any help to them. It won't certainly be of use to the others that I do serve. So in each circumstance, be aware that there is room for improvement. Again, you wouldn't even be listening to tonight's show if you don't need to improve. If you do need to improve, and therefore you're listening, how many other people need to improve or not, then this is the opportunity and time to do so. And think of it in the long-term process that you're moving in a direction that truly is miraculous. From improvement comes miracles in terms of human understanding. It's not a miracle to me because I see it more scientifically, but it is still miraculous in terms of what humans believe is possible. So the impossible or the likely impossible becomes an everyday event. And the ability to think thousands of times faster, or tens of thousands of times faster, is a miracle when you operate it and use it in ways to be of service to others. And of course, if you didn't do that, you wouldn't have the ability anymore anyway. So it's sort of an oxymoron, you can't do it. Okay, so I hope tonight's show has really made a difference. I hope that you do re-listen to it maybe one time or more, because there was an awful lot covered, more than I probably ever have on this subject, and maybe in ways that is more helpful for those who already have some clue, had some clue of what this was about. And if you don't, then listen to it again and again, because eventually I think you will get it. And also remember, you can email me, you can call. And I am reachable. It is possible. And for the sake of brevity, the last few weeks I haven't really even been doing any extra commercials or anything, because I want to get these subjects that I think are important to me, and hopefully they are to you, out there, so that there's a more complete understanding. All right, well, we're pretty much done. So I hope this has been a great show for you. And until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.